Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
If I ever did sing karaoke or whatever you call that stuff, this is my go-to song right here.
And a long neck bottle.
Yeah, I can normally hide inside his vocals pretty well. And I know when you do karaoke, there's no vocals, it's just you. So I think I could clone it. Joining me from, I believe, still Taiwan, is Grant Newsham. Grant, good evening, good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Do you, karaoke is a big thing in the Pacific Rim. Are you a karaoke guy?
You know, actually, I discovered after I moved out this way that I have a talent for it. I'm not making this up, believe it or not. But it's a very narrow range. It's like if you go to Vegas and like you go up on, as I say, to one of these casinos, like on the fourth floor, there's some little lounge and there's a guy singing. That'd be about me. You know, it's like oily lounge singer, but my voice, for some reason, that's what it is. It was a huge surprise to me and like everyone who's ever met me. I'm pretty good. I will admit to that.
Whoa. This is like Stop the Presses event here on All Marine Radio.
Yeah, what, I know what you mean.
You said you have a very limited range, but you have a range unlike the rest of us. What, who do you sing? What do you do?
I say, if you think oily lounge singer, you know, whatever that repertoire is, like, I was like some Italian guy from Jersey.
Give me one title.
I probably sing Fly Me to the Moon better than Sinatra. But if I had to choose one, it would be David Lee Roth's Just a Gigolo. I'm telling you, Churchill was born to save Western civilization. I was born to sing that song. Is there anything else you'd like to
do? Do you do this sober?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You have to. If you need a drink to sing, you really shouldn't be up there.
Wow.
Says I.
Says you. That's awesome.
But believe me, nobody was more surprised than me to discover this.
Is there a place that enjoys now? Is it karaoke? Or how do you actually pronounce it? Because I've been told that's not the correct pronunciation.
It's not. You say karaoke.
Karaoke.
Yeah, if you said karaoke, like. Everyone knows what you mean, but it's, so you can say it in an American way or you can say it the correct way, but since we're the Americans, we can say it however we want. But if you say karaoke, everyone will know what you're talking about. Once they have to like mentally adjust for a second, oh yeah, yeah, that's what's going on. But that's, if you said it the correct way in America, nobody would know what you're talking about.
That is true. What are you talking about?
With what you're doing it the way you're doing it.
Karaoke. Now I understand. What about, is there a place in the Pacific Rim that loves it more?
I think Japan is considered the homeland of,
it is as well as the birthplace. Yes.
I think so. I think that's why they started World War II, was to protect karaoke. But the Korea, it's big. Taiwan, Singapore, it's just, you can go all over the place and they'll have, you know, it's all over the place. But Japan is, the place. So,
now do you make this a habit? In terms of your movement around the Pacific Rim, is there a segment of people in Taiwan that say, oh my God, thank God Grant's back?
No. No, I only do it when I'm called to perform. It wouldn't be like what am I going to do tonight? You know, well, let's go sing. There's some reason that it's usually, you know, it, I would be like, have to go out with some people or,
and you find yourself there and they say, let's go do this. And they say, Grant, it's your turn. And then you,
I'll I don't have to wait to be asked. I'll get right into the line with the box and, you know, try to elbow people out of the way. But the, or some, you know, I've in the past, I've been called upon to like, I've mentioned, you know, that I have this, sort of unanticipated skill. And I've been called on to either put up or shut up. And I have shut people up more than once.
Really? And so you just get your David Lee Roth on? Is it complete with boa or no boa?
No, no, no. Not the not that homoerotica stuff. But the,
you go straight heteroerotic stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Got it.
I was once at this is I had was singing with some Japanese men, some business guys. They you know, invited me out. So I was singing and I heard them actually I could hear them on the side as I was singing and one of them said, "Wow, he speaks English pretty well." And, which well yeah, that is what I
You know, anyway. It is one of the things that you learn when you get to the Far East, in short order, is that people that can't speak the language will get up on stage and sing Elvis or the Beatles, and you're like, it's jaw-dropping. And then I remember being out in Kinville in 1985, and this Japanese band got up and played the Beatles. And when they were taking a break, we were drinking, and we said, "Hey, you know, how'd you learn the Beatles or something?" And they were like, you know, they looked at us and essentially said, "No habla," in Japanese, of course. And we were like, "What do you like? You don't speak the?" They looked at you like, "No." They're like, one of their friends said, "They don't speak English." It's like, well, what were they doing on stage? Oh, that they're singing a song, right? And I was like,
"Yeah, that's it." You know, the entire Japanese nation. I think they know the song "Country Roads" by
John Denver,
and I mean everyone. That is probably by far the most well known and popular song in karaoke.
Really?
And, yeah, you know, and I'm from Virginia.
Which so is right next door to West Virginia.
Well, that's
and
the problem. When I tell people I'm from Virginia, every time they say, "Oh, West Virginia." And, you know, I'm, of course, bristle at that. But, you know, I'm married to my sister. They, you know, I have to explain to them that there is a difference between the two. And so it's pretty funny, actually. But that every time, that's what they're responsible for.
Really? Well, you know, I just recently played that song for my daughter on YouTube because at the end of West Virginia football games, right, University of West Virginia, when they're home, it's like the fans of, what, Alabama singing Sweet Home Alabama, right? They lose their minds when they do this stuff. And the same thing in West Virginia. They sing, you know, they sing that song and here comes John Denver and the whole stadium is singing it. You're like,
oh boy.
What is it about the hillbillies that love their music, right? That love their music. All right. Enough of that. What a surprise. Things you don't know. You've written a few pieces since the last time we talked to you. The CIA should know if China lied on COVID-19. Explain to me, what is your thesis and what conclusion have you drawn?
Okay, well, the piece I wrote is one it's sort of asking a question which I think has probably come up in a lot of people's minds since this virus appeared, and particularly when there's so much doubt or not doubt, but there's this question: is did the Chinese know? Did they create the thing? Where did it come from? Did it leak out of a lab? Did Xi Jinping himself order the cover up and then allow 5 million Chinese to travel overseas just to make sure everybody got sick if China was going to get sick? And all these questions that come up, which are important ones for our national security. You'd think that somebody already knew. You know, this is the CIA's job, is to get useful intelligence from overseas against targets which are most important to the United States. And it's hard to imagine one more important than China. And it's hard to imagine an issue more important than this virus. And yet you listen to, you know, the administration or the U.S. government people talking, it's as if they're getting what they know from reading the newspapers. You know, they should have this. My point is they should have this question. It should have been answered immediately. You know, they should have had intelligence sources in place to be able to answer these questions that are so fundamental. And, you know, so I wrote the article says, well, shouldn't they already know? And I then go on to actually explain that the way it sort of works at the CIA is that it's too hard to recruit. Well, one, that the Chinese have had huge counterintelligence successes against CIA's assets.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that a footnote? Is that a footnote in all of this?
Well, it is, but I would suggest that even if they hadn't, they still can't. They don't seem to be very good at getting the information we need. And I point out, you know, you've seen this before with, you know, Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, the rise of ISIS, which apparently the CIA were the only people on the planet that didn't see it coming. It's just one list of intelligence failure after another. And what you've got is a dynamic, which I would suggest is that the organization, it's a fundamental question of what do people get, what sort of activity is rewarded, and in the sort of the intelligence collection part of that business, you are rewarded because you get so-called scalps, which means you have recruited a foreign person to provide allegedly secret information. And if every scalp is considered pretty much of equal value, well, which are you going to go after? You're going to go after a tough target, say Islamic terrorists or Chinese or Russians, or are you going to go after, say, like anybody in Africa? Or like anybody in Southeast Asia, just about, or with a nice lunch and some money, you can recruit them. You find that resources and efforts go at one. There's two things. They tend to go against the targets of least importance, but that are easiest to recruit. And additionally, there's a tendency to fabricate both intelligence and recruitment that some people have observed in the organization. And that's what I'm pointing out. I'm suggesting that there is a, you know, instead of the patient, really competent effort against the targets of most importance, but rather the organization for a long time seems to have done best against easy targets that aren't of much, really much of importance to the U.S. national interest. And you saw this in spades on 9/11 when the World Trade Center came down. If the terrorists had been from West Africa, I suspect the entire country would have been recruited. But this thing caught the country blindsided. They had not done the work against the targets of most importance, and everything that's come of that, you know, we all know, and it's not been good. But after the towers came down, you heard all the excuses for it. Well, we didn't have enough money. Oh, we had to get permission. Blah blah blah. And even the most amazing one was, well, it was hard. It was a hard target. What do you expect us to get it? Well, it's your job. And that's what the article is getting at, is saying it'd be nice if the CIA could at least give us some hint that it could spy properly. Of course, it could be they're just not telling us, which would be a good thing. But the administration is not acting like it's got some inside information that's sort of resolved the issue, unless they're doing a masterful job of pretending otherwise and trying to lead on the Chinese. But you don't get that impression. So that's what I was writing about.
Now, the headline says this, and I know you don't write the headline. Oh, it doesn't ask a question. It makes a statement. It says CIA should know if China lied on COVID-19. Okay. I was kind of transposing words in my head. Should the CIA know? I thought, you know, as a headline, should that have a question mark?
That's how I would have done the headline, but I didn't do it. But,
right.
It's nonetheless true as a statement that they should know. That's what you get paid for. And it's what, you know, you're supposed to do. I use an analogy in the piece to, you know, an airline pilot, you know, if suppose you had an airline pilot who says, well, I don't land in 30 knot crosswinds. I'm just not going to do it. And it's not what I do. And what you've got, if the apparently with our premier intelligence agency saying, well, this is so hard that we can't do it. Well, either figure it out or get people who can do it. And that's the there's one organization that's important for this country. It's that it's the CIA. And they, you know, citizens like me, we do kind of wonder exactly what they're doing. And when it comes to getting intelligence, and I also mentioned in the article that the paramilitary business that the CIA has gotten into, you know, that's gotten so much attention, it's a lot, whole lot of fun, but it isn't what they're supposed to be doing. You either get intelligence, you know, the CIA's role is to get secret intelligence, not to run paramilitary operations. So I would actually be inclined to, if I was the Congress, to say, okay, if you guys can prove to us that you can actually get, you know, people, to, you know, if you can actually recruit useful people and get information that will allow a president to say, I know exactly what the Chinese did with this virus, then we'll let you do the fun stuff, which is the paramilitary part. But the, I'm obviously being half joking, but only half, because it is that, it does appear to be that problematic, you know, from certainly my perspective, and others have written on this over the years. There was actually an excellent article in the, I think it was the Atlantic, of all places, about 30 years ago, written by a guy named Edward Shirley, which lays things out very, very well. And it's, I think the title is something like, Can't Anybody Spy Here? And I think he really got to the, gets to the heart of it. And I've never heard anything since then to suggest things have gotten any better.
Yeah,
but it was an easy, really easy one to write. Usually the articles take all sorts of effort, but this one just flowed out easily.
Interesting. The, I found it interesting, though, you know, much of the discussion. I mean, the first article I saw that postulated that this, the COVID-19 virus, more than likely came out of the lab in one of the two labs in Wuhan. The story about the wet market was a disinformation story. That was an academic. The first part of it was academics saying that for years there's been discussion that the procedures around the labs needed to be tightened up. And more than likely, this was an inadvertent transmission, you know, based on a lack of appropriate hygiene procedures at the lab itself. And so that was written by a Chinese academic talking about lab procedures, not by a political pundit, not by a national security advisor, but that was a Chinese. And I was surprised, and it got published, you know, outside of China, obviously, which is why we had access to it. But that's the first I saw of it. And I find it interesting that this whole discussion of the insinuation was it was never man-made, right? And so the question is, did it originate in one of the Wuhan facilities? And the answer to that is no. Well, what some people don't understand is there's a difference between originated or did it come out of, right? Because, of course, it originated in nature, in these bats that I guess have this shit, right? But, and so you see this word game getting played by the Chinese in particular. Of this, it was not man-made, right? Which is trying to get around the, okay, here's the next question. Did it come from one of your facilities? Oh, that. Right. So you see this, the X-Acto knife gotten out, right? And we're weaving between words and syllables, carving this thing out, you know, akin to that depends on what your definition of is, which to me is the ultimate X-Acto knife move I've ever seen make it into the public airwaves. So it seems very interesting to watch the game that gets played relative to accepting responsibility for what China's delivered to the whole world to enjoy.
Yeah, I think you've described it correctly as the word games that get played here, and not just by the Chinese, but if from the U.S. side, if one even suggested that this had not come from the so-called wet market, you would just be savaged by a good chunk of the American experts. You can't, almost really on the grounds that you can't say this. You know, it was just really this just intense attack for anyone who just pointed out the logical, you know, just the question. You know, you have this virus. It's appeared in the one place where they have two virology labs. And we know that just anyone who's been around China or, you know, watches their chemical plants blow up routinely, that what's so-called industrial hygiene is terrible. You know, so is it possible at least that, you know, the thing might have come out of there regardless of, you know, who created it? But you can't even say that. And now it's gradually coming in that direction. But for a long time during this incident, you couldn't even raise that issue, the possibility that somehow it came out of a sort of a Chinese facility, which just shows just how insane we've gotten. But it is, once again, if you're back to the CIA, you know, couldn't they just put us out of our misery and tell the president at least, look, this is where it came from and this is why we know. Instead, you can see how, you know, the administration has to sort of talk in hypotheticals, because it just appears they don't have conclusive evidence that, you know, that they should have. And if they don't have it, well, who are they supposed to get that from? Just going back a little earlier, it was always said that by some people that probably the CIA's most important recruitment after 9/11 was the CIA director George Tenet recruiting George Bush, as there's simply no other way that Tenet could have kept his job. But so I don't get it. And I think a lot of people just don't understand it, that, you know, this is an organization whose job it is to get difficult to get inside information and make sure that our leadership, whatever party, whatever president, really has this sort of X-ray vision or 20/20 vision on an issue and doesn't have to, you know, kind of drift, you know, for an $80 billion intelligence budget a year, you'd think this would be a reasonable question to answer with some degree of certainty.
You know, I remember hearing General Zinni talk about intelligence, and he said, and this is in around 1990. And so he said then, he said, what I get now, I get more. I don't get better. What we need is a way to distill this stuff, right? And maybe artificial intelligence will solve all this for us. But he said, what I need is a way to account for it all and distill this stuff. And it's got to come to me in a form so that I, as a decision maker, can take action, or it helps me take action. And that's not what I get now. And we've expanded on our ability to produce information, you know, ad nauseum. And that's one of the problems with 9/11. You can go back and say, well, here's the report. Well, if you know anything about intelligence, it's from an unverifiable source that's reporting for the first time. How much credibility do you assign that report in a sea of, right, 600, you know, or 6,000 reports today, that data byte? How much credibility do you assign it? So, you know, to me, his lament is in fact the truth in terms of, and it doesn't seem like our intelligence community has been able to come to grips with the qualitative piece of this, you know, in the midst of this tsunami of information they collect.
It does seem that way. And once again, you know, it goes back to, is it good and is it important information provided by some guy who'd get a bullet in his head if he got caught? And that's the hard, everything depends on getting that kind of information. And either you produce that or you don't. And if you don't, well, then you're not doing your job. And it doesn't matter if it's a difficult job. So that, you know, it really comes down to that. It doesn't matter how many analysts you have. It doesn't matter if you are reorganized into mission centers or whatever.
Right.
If you're not getting information from the right sources, it does, nothing else matters. And that is where the I think it's pretty obvious there seems to be a – it's pretty obvious, it seems to be. But it certainly appears from my perspective that they – you know, haven't got what they need to answer the most important questions about China. And, you know, you had, you know, just in recent memory, you had what this acting director of the CIA, this Mike Morrell fella who appears on TV all the time. You had him say that, well, we missed ISIS. We didn't see it coming. Wow. You know, it, you know, you hardly know what to say. One, ISIS was easy, and they couldn't figure it out. And that's how you get to the top of that place. It does raise some concerns. And that's, you know, this is really is nothing new. You know, anything that I've said, you know, you could have heard it any time over the last 30 years. So there we are.
The CIA, not impressed. Talk to me about the Chinese Marine Corps. You and I have talked about China, and you know, if you want to have a global if you want to have a global presence, then you've got to be able to project power. And key to projecting power is amphibious operations, in which you can come from sea to anywhere. You wrote a piece entitled "Stand By." China's Marine Corps to operate in all terrains around the globe to serve the nation. What's the thrust of that?
Unfortunately, I didn't write it.
I knew that. I was just seeing if you'd be candid.
Yeah, I know. I passed it along. It was unfortunately the Chinese wrote it, and it was pretty much the Chinese telling us what they're going to do, and they've been telling us for years, but we've just chosen not to believe them. And it's an article in something called Global Times, which is the, how do you call it? It's part of the Chinese media propaganda hierarchy. And it's the one where you get the really the most outlandish, the unvarnished statement of what the Chinese think and about what they're going to do. And what the article says is exactly what you just said, is that the Chinese Marine Corps is going to operate overseas, not just in the areas immediately around China, is going to operate overseas to support and defend and protect Chinese interests. And, you know, now that China's getting out and about with all of its, you know, Belt and Road Initiative, all these economic activities, setting up a sort of a military base for starters in Djibouti, you know, just down the road from Camp Le Monnier, where the Marines are, and that since China's going to it's a great international power and it's got interests overseas, the Marine Corps, Chinese Marine Corps, is going to protect those, and it is going to develop the skills for this, and the equipment, the hardware, the know-how, and you will see the Chinese Marines out and about wherever there's Chinese interests overseas. This will take a little while to get it fully up to speed, but don't underestimate them. This is just a question of time. And they also say that, you know, we're not just about amphibious operations. You know, it's really a very any climb and place sort of statement by the Chinese Marines.
How dare they?
About what they're going to do. Yeah, so that's what the piece was about, and I sent it out saying it's of interest to people like us, but it does show what the Chinese, not just these are intentions, but when the Chinese say they're going to do something, they generally tend to do it, and so this is something that we're going to have to deal with, is figure out how to handle the, you know, an assertive, well, we've been had to figure it out for a long time, but this new sort of avenue of assertiveness by the Chinese, where you've got a Marine Corps that is going to operate at least like we used to, like the Marine Corps does, like our Marine Corps does. And, you know, we'll see how this goes. But it was a very interesting, clear statement. And it makes even more mystifying why the Commandant of the Marine Corps in 2008 visited the Chinese Marine Corps and gave them a pep. Well, one, visited in the first place, people that you knew we were going to have to fight someday, and then gave them effectively a pep talk. It is mystifying that we were doing this, because this was what was coming from the Chinese was obvious at least 20 years ago, and certainly by 2008. There really was no excuse for trying to have a love fest and become best friends forever with the Chinese Marines. And if the idea was, well, if they see how great we are, they'll back off because they know they'll never take us on. That was getting some bad advice from somebody. So here we are. One thing about the Chinese is they're easier to predict or to figure out than the Canadians. The Chinese tell us what they're going to do, and they tell us what they think of us and what they're going to do about it. And they, as I said, they will generally do what they say they will unless something gets in the way.
Which brings us to the subject of the United States Marine Corps. You and I both saw the article that former Marine and Secretary of Navy James Webb wrote. It has gotten certainly a lot of attention among Marines, and so I'd be curious about your thoughts on that as you sit in Taiwan. What are your thoughts on what Secretary Webb put out over the weekend?
Some of it resonated with me, and everybody will see it differently. You know, this whole issue of reforming and reshifting the Marine Corps. I think everybody who's ever in the Marines or been in the Marines has got an interest in it, and everyone tends to see it a little bit differently. But so I'm just can only talk to how it strikes me is that I think some of it resonated, particularly some of his criticism of things. And Jim Webb, actually, I think I said 20 years ago that he uses the English language probably better than anybody writing in it these days. He's a very good reader, a good writer, which generally means you're also thinking clear. If you write clearly, you're thinking clearly.
Did you have any exposure to him while you were on one? Well, have you ever crossed paths with him? I mean, you're both. He's a fellow Virginian, isn't he?
He may be from West Virginia. No, I don't know. He's from the hills, actually. He wrote that book about the Scots-Irish, Fighting Mad or something like that, years ago. And so I think he's from that a ways, but I think he'd be more of hill people, I would think. But no, I've never come across him. But he's, as I say, so I think very highly of him. That's what I'm getting at.
Got it.
But this piece, though, as I read it, I felt like he had, and while some of his criticism, did say resonated, by the time he, I sort of got to the point of, okay, that's fine. Now, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about the Chinese threat in particular? And that's where the piece didn't really get into that. And in fact, I don't think it got into it at all, as I recall. And so that's the question I would have is that, how are we going to take on China? And that's what the article doesn't address. The one thing that I, one sort of thing that stuck with me is Mr. Webb, mentioned that the plan to cut 3 infantry battalions, or I think it was, from the Marine Corps, and he points out that that's perhaps ill-advised because you're going to need them for casualty replacements, and if you get into a serious war, you're going to go through people pretty quickly. But what I would have liked to have seen addressed is, well, how are we if we get into a serious war with China, that And how are we going to fight it? That's what I would like to know, because I would suggest that if we fight it using the same approach that we take now, that I would suggest 30 infantry battalions won't make up for the casualties or the POWs that we're going to lose. So that's where I would, you know, I would like, maybe there's another article coming that is to actually, okay, how are we going to take on the Chinese? Because I do see us facing something that is that our traditional approach to business, I don't think see how it can work in those circumstances against this adversary.
Okay, so let's. I want to ask you about that. I mean, you much of your professional life has been devoted to the Pacific Rim. How would you, were you king for a day, how would you configure the Marine Corps, or at least, you know, part of the Marine Corps? Because to me, the configuring the whole Marine Corps for the fight in the South China Sea, I mean, we all can't get there. So what's the point of that? I mean, there's different threats in different parts of the world. You know, one model doesn't fit all. So, I mean, I don't get that. But I'd be curious, how do you see the Marine Corps contributing? Because what you hear is, long-range precision fires means massing you cannot do. It means that, like, turn out your light in your bedroom at night, and that's, you know, what's going to happen. Well, we know that that's not normally the way it happens. So, but yet that's this narrative of these long range precision fires that rule everything. And I have a problem with that. To me, you know, phase one is everybody gets their eyes poked out. Satellites go. So now the real fight becomes a fight for target acquisition. And how do you, I can't shoot. Like, if they want to blow up Guam, go ahead. If they want to knock Theodore Roosevelt's nose off Mount Rushmore, go ahead. Okay? So I struggle with this conception of, you know, long-range precision fire, artificial intelligence, till somebody finds a way to jam all that shit electronically, and then it's all for naught. So this wasn't a transformation. It wasn't a revolution. It was another in the long evolution of warfare. And we listen to people who've been wrong historically. And I mean, and history is full of these people that they predict some, you know, the French predicted the Maginot Line would be the solution, you know, to the Germans. Wrong. Right. Those who advocated the tank said the tank would rule in all cases. Wrong. You know, and so I'm curious, in the midst of all that, incredibly articulate oration, how do you see a fight with the Chinese developing? Or do you? Right? Or do you? Because you can make the case that the European Defense Initiative that has us much further militarily engaged, you know, in Eastern Europe, now in Poland and places like that. We're now in the Ukraine, or, you know, in the Baltic states and whatnot. And the fact that we're there more often, we're there in more numbers, sends the message of preemption to Russia, right? And there's a similar thing now being conceived for the Pacific. How do you conceive it? And so to me, in my mind, the more I think of it, and you and I discuss this, if you don't win the diplomatic and economic fight now, you know, you'll probably fight whatever conflict happens to some sort of maybe stalemate as you trade blows and then stop. And, you know, China's still going to have to worry about the first island chain. How do you see that? And if you are in Vietnam, if you are in Malaysia, if you are in Indonesia, both diplomatically and robustly economically, then ultimately you will get there militarily. And if you are in those places, then they can't win that fight. So how do you see this, and what do you see as important?
Well, what you've I offer a few ideas, and what you've laid out is, it really is the inessential part of all of this, is the economic, the diplomatic, the political effort that has to be made in these places. And without it, you've reduced your chances of success probably by 80%. It just can't be a purely military solution. And they, given the psychological aspect of international relations and even of warfare, or even that period before war that determines if you're going to even get in the war in the first place. But so that has to be part of the considerations. But nonetheless, we talk about from a military perspective, and what would you do to present the Chinese with something they would not want to face? And that is how I tend to look at the sort of a shoot up in the region, is what would the Chinese least like to have to deal with? And I would suggest that we've talked about this before, that it's geography that is their biggest challenge. And it's also our biggest advantage if we play it right. And that the nature of the region is has a lot of islands, a lot of coastline, and it's this maze maze kind of through which China has to move in order to get out of the region, or to get away from the Chinese mainland, to get out into the Pacific. It's that so-called first island chain, and then there's a second island chain too. If you have to, in worst case, you have to fall back there, but you can also defend from there. And the idea here is to actually operate from a strategic defense. And that is to force the Chinese to come through. And that is where the geography is so useful, that because and where I think that the so-called long-range precision weapons are so important is because the technology is such that one of these things can crack a ship in half. There's going to the back to the Mediterranean, there's a reason the Israeli Navy doesn't want to get too close to Lebanon, because of the fear of Hezbollah's anti-ship missiles or even jury-rigged anti-tank weapons that can do pretty well. So we're seeing a change in technology that has affected the way we can do business. So I think the basic idea of having small, hard-to-find units on these archipelagos, covering these straits, is one that is a good one. And I think it's an efficient way to do it. And, think of us trying to fight our way through that. One good historic example is, remember World War II down in Guadalcanal, where the Japanese Navy would come down during the nighttime and, shoot up the Marines and also shoot up the U.S. Navy. And for months, the Japanese got the better of this. And that's why it's called Iron Bottom Sound. Off of Guadalcanal, but they had to come down through those close quarters, through the narrow straits. And the Australians had these brave coast watchers all along there who were hidden and would spot the Japanese ships and aircraft coming and give out give some heads up. Now, suppose the coast watchers had anti-ship missiles. That would have made some very long nights for the Japanese trying to get through, and I would submit that they couldn't have. And it would have simplified what we were doing on Guadalcanal. It would have simplified what the Navy was doing. And so that's where I can see, if you use terrain to your advantage and take advantage of the new sorts of weapons, particularly, once again, the anti-ship missile, anti-air stuff's good. And if you could somehow work in smart mines with the new technology being what it is, you can effectively close off these access routes for the Chinese military. And you're operating from the strategic defensive, like Slim would have done when let the Japanese come to India.
All right, now let me
come over. So that's one way. That's how I tend to look at it, is the most effective.
And I won't disagree with you, but I would say that I believe that you're more valuable as a coast watcher than you are as a shooter to me, because I can shoot that thing from 1,000 miles away. Right? I mean, if somebody can show me the target in this world where my eyes have been poked out, right? Now I've got somebody that's in a position to observe. And just know this. I mean, we say this in pure war, but, you know, the 2nd Marine Division went to 29 Palms here, and they exercised like it was real. And, you know, your Alpha and Bravo command group both got very, very small. They radiated digitally for literally for minutes and then packed everything up and sprinted away. They broadcasted from remote antennas so that they wouldn't compromise their own position and then had to move. So again, when we talk peer warfare, know this. If you radiate, you get shot. And so your value, I think, you know, to me, our value is not so much as shooters as it is target identification. And you know, I saw an article over the weekend about, you know, the Navy's interested in some developing some prototype for amphibious ships that have like 40 sailors and 75 Marines on it, and that would be, you know, supporting this. I mean, is it me, or do you think that Chinese merchant navy would be following those son of a bitches every time they moved?
Well, that's good. That's part of the game, and it's right? Almost, you know, almost glad I'm not, don't have to worry about it so much. Well, don't at all, actually. But the way that warfare is changing, you know, it's getting so hard to hide, and that is, you know, until we come up with some counter to that. And that's one of the things that makes it so, you know, this notion of large amphibious task force moving around, or even aircraft carriers, that it's hard to hide. And these things are good targets. And you mentioned, well, you know, you can hit a target from 1,000 miles away. And that, you know, that's not hyperbole.
No.
And it's going to get a lot longer than that.
And so, that means, Grant, from Australia, I don't even have to go to sea.
The nature of this war, of warfare, it really is changing, and they to state the obvious. But you know, the one so that we all tend to look at this from a perspective. And I am a friend of the other day who was a old time tank officer. Actually, he referred to the Marines as really splendid light infantry, which is kind of what they've always been, but with a MAGTAF, you know, with this combined arms sort of joint approach to it. I mean, you know, and that's, you know, you think, I was thinking about it, you know, well, it is true that that's what the Marines are, is really good light infantry. And then I thought, well, so were the Zulus. But the Zulus couldn't figure out how to deal with the Maxim gun, with machine gun, or even the Martini Henry rifle. And they no matter how good they were at, you know, their light infantry stuff, it was that technological disadvantage that they had to overcome. They didn't. And the way that I look at this is part of it. And there's so many aspects to it that it's hard. It's a difficult thing to actually figure out, you know, what the Marines should be doing. But I look at the Chinese long range missile rocket threat, and really along with their ISR, the intelligence gathering and surveillance capabilities, and the autonomous weapons and drones that are going to be coming. I look at these as something akin to the Maxim gun that the Zulus had to figure out. And we've got to figure out a way to deal with an enemy who has those capabilities, can do these things to us. And if we don't figure it out, we're going to find ourselves like the Zulus at Ulundi, the last battle, where they looked impressive, but the British kind of felt sorry for them. So that's where I see it, is that the technology has changed so much that, and also the intelligence, the surveillance aspects of all this, that we've got to figure that out. And it can't be just doing more of what we've always done. Fortunately, it does seem as though we are trying to figure out, and I think we do have, not just the Marines, but the U.S. writ large has some things up its sleeve that it's working on. But that's so, you know, that's, you know, one sort of frame of reference that I use is that, you know, the Zulus and the Maxim gun, you know, how do we get over that? And you know, I just throw that out for discussion.
I just don't, you know, here's the other thing. I don't see, like, I'm trying to conceive of, like, what would start a shooting war between the United States and China, and then what could China hope to get? So China invade Taiwan? You know, it just to me, the juice isn't worth the squeeze. I mean, as you pointed out to me, they believe they'll take it over naturally over time. Same thing that's happened in Hong Kong. Slowly but surely, the boa constrictor tightens itself and then it crushes you. And so to do it militarily against the United States, you know, to me seems crazy. Let me ask you this. Is there a chance that the, let's just say we have these 30 amphibs. We have 75 Marines on each one. Okay, so how many total is that? 75 times 30. Are you good at Grant? Are you good at math, Grant?
If I have a calculator.
That's 2,200. That's 2,250 Marines on these boats. Right. That's two battalions. You know, on these boats mm-hmm. that you have down there, and they're going to be harassed by the Chinese merchant. The Chinese fishing fleet in the region. Now, if you don't have great relationships, both diplomatic, economic, and militarily with Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines, what are the odds that you're going to, like, roll into the South China Sea region? And if China does have better relations than we do, in a competitive sense, and they are more in those places than we are, what are the odds that you're going to kind of roll in there with your 30 ships and do anything?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the, you know, that I think is one of the real weaknesses of the Commandant's plan, is, or one of the things that needs resolved is the, you know, even assuming that you do think that it is possible to use geography to your advantage, and I think it is, that okay, well, where are you going to put these people? And I think we've touched on this before, is that you don't just show up like when things get difficult or dangerous and say, and fight your way in and set up shop. But the idea is, if this is going to work, you have got to get in now. And really, and this is demonstrates the importance of real partners who can operate with us and who want to operate with us, you know, who think that we're committed, that we're the guys that are going to, you know, that they want to align with, and they will take their chances getting China angry by aligning with us. And because we haven't done this, you know, despite 50 years of joint exercises, and each of which allegedly built interoperability and habitual, habits of cooperation, et cetera, but was really nothing more than a Harlem Globetrotters show with a nice barbecue at the end, that this is a fundamental flaw, is we've got to figure out how to get in there and to have some partners who are linked to us, of course, militarily, but also politically, psychologically, economically.
So before there's a Pacific Defense Initiative, there needs to be an American diplomatic and economic offensive thrust in the region that then opens the door for the Pacific Defense Initiative.
I would tend to, I agree. It's just the sequence. You know, I would tend right. to, I think time is a wasting, as they say in West Virginia, but I'd hurry this along really fast. And, you know, one interesting example is the Federated States of Micronesia, which is, it's surprising how many people don't know where they are, but they're like right in the middle of the Pacific.
Right.
Until a young U.S. Foreign Service officer on the make wants to get himself assigned to Micronesia, we don't have much of a chance. You know, everyone wants to go to Vienna and, you know, and London and this sort of thing. But who wants to get assigned to, you know, Micronesia or Tonga or Fiji? These places that are far more important to us, to the nation, but, you know, the diplomats don't really want to go. And this administration is trying to pay some more attention, but that's one of the fundamental problems, is that we haven't gotten the political end of it right. You know, we're not very good at political warfare. We could be, but we decide we don't want to, apparently. But so that is a huge part of the thing. And I would tend to try to do both at the same time, because there's a lot of goodwill for us out there if we can capitalize on it. But back to the Commandant's plan, that I think that we've got to figure out some other way to take on the Chinese. And if you look at it from the Chinese perspective, I would like to present them with our own A2AD, anti-access area denial network, that they have to go through, rather than us talking about ways of getting through theirs.
It's already there, but we don't seem to be willing. It doesn't seem like it has the president's attention, because, to me, and you and I have talked about this before, if you don't like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, then, let's get, the right people into the region and let's negotiate so that your best trading partner is the United States. It is the United States, the EU, Canada, Mexico, that kind of consortium. And let's make it so that those countries, we can make sure their boats rise, because that's how we create a stable world. That's how we reemphasize rules-based order, and we don't allow China to steal the march on us. But that does not seem like it's on the president's menu.
Well, he's got a lot of things on it. There are people in the U.S. government, I believe do get paid to do these sorts of things. I'm not entirely – they don't appear to get paid to produce, but they
thank God for them, right?
Yeah, so you say the president's got, and this administration has done far more than any of the others, but it's just a drop in the bucket, unfortunately, of what needs done. But what you've described is an essential part of the piece of the puzzle. One hopes we figure it out. Really time is wasting, and you look at the extent that the Chinese have managed to get their sort of their economic and political claws into, say, Micronesia, into the Central Pacific, the South Pacific, that it ought to be worrisome. And us with the Australians, New Zealanders, the Koreans, and the Japanese, and even the Indians in particular, could be very helpful. And we've got a lot to work with. But if you want an example of of how we tend to do things, the November before last, there was a handsome press conference about something called, I think, the Build Initiative, that was going to develop infrastructure in the Pacific. And like so many of these things that U.S. go, these initiatives, they're really handsome press conferences, and then nothing much comes of them. And there's another good one more recently called the Blue Dot Initiative. I mean, if you look it up on the internet, it's just the classic example of sort of a U.S. government initiative that's a press conference. And then there doesn't seem to be anybody who gets promoted or fired, depending on how well this program produces. We've got to get over this sort of thing, and we don't have all that much time. This is all cheerful stuff.
Here's an email. Mac, I have to tell you, I'm stunned after hearing that the ships we want have 75 Marines. That's 2,200 guys rolling around. And we're going to keel the rest of the Marine Corps in their likeness? When we can't get to that fight, doesn't sound smart to me. And I'm nobody to be criticizing nobody. But come on, the most likely conflicts we will get in are not in the South China Sea, and they're not in China trying to break the first island chain militarily. I don't get it. I appreciate always Grant's insight. I am the smartest guy I know relative to the Pacific Rim, listening to him. Grant, you might be, a big time karaoke. How do you say it in Japanese?
If you pronounce it like it's Spanish, karaoke.
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 Got it. All right. But
and then nobody in America will know what you're talking about. So
nobody has done more for your notoriety than All Marine Radio, for God's sakes. I mean, you have a cult following on All Marine Radio like no other, man. I mean, I mean, I have family members that talk about you, and I'm like, oh, for the love of God, stop it already.
I agree. They should find somebody else to talk about.
No, but every one of them talks about the amount of knowledge that they've got from listening to you, and about the region. You know, what goes on in the region, how China behaves economically in terms of their, you know, their gangster-like images, not images, but their gangster-like behavior. And they just did it again, I want to say within the last 10 days, to the Europeans when, Mike Pompeo was saying, hey, China needs to be held accountable, you know, and the Chinese sent messages to Europe, right? Hey, you throw them into the United States and watch what happens. And the European Union backed off the initial statement they were going to make.
Yep, sure enough. The email the listener sent in, you know, it's, I think it, to me, it, you know, I think a lot of us have a similar sort of a reaction to this, the Commandant's plan, is that it has, I don't think it's been explained very well. Ultimately, there's different. Everyone seems to interpret it differently, and you could read it some ways. And it sounds like, you know, the MAGTAF is a thing of the past. It sounds like, oh, we're going to become this rocket force, and that's it. But the say so. We I think it would have been, I think it should have been rolled out a lot better than it was. You know, I think the giving Asia Pacific the attention it properly deserves at long last.
Right.
I think that is the right thing, because that is the one place where we could lose. But
what I would tell you is nobody quarrels with that, right?
You'd be surprised. Well, actually, my experience over, 25 years is that actually the Marine Corps prefers the sandbox. It is just amazing how little attention, you know, Asia Pacific has gotten, and particularly the threat that's coming. This is, you know, that's been my experience. You know, you'd think this would be the place
I think you're a little jaded over like the 2.5 decades of go away grant that you got. Okay.
And I didn't even get that.
You need to get over that. Okay. Because I think most people have grudgingly acknowledged like, yeah, we do need to pivot towards the Pacific. Yeah, we do need to look at that problem. But, you know, again, the Marine Corps' utility to the nation has not been as a one-trick pony. It is, we do windows. We have a blonde wig. We have a black wig. We have a brown wig. We have a red wig. And if you wanted a different color, just tell us, baby, because we'll dye that son of a bitch whatever color you want us to be, and we'll get there. It has been our flexibility as a force, our cost effectiveness as a force, and we will get there tonight, and we'll bring a chain when we get there, right? And that's what we've been historically to the nation. Now the Marine Corps is being told, and again, my criticism of the Commandant comes from the dozens of people that have either reached out to me or I've spoken to this, you know, All Marine Radio going into its fifth year now. And so, I mean, just look at the people who come on this program. And I'm not going to name anybody's names because if they want to be named, they certainly have the avenue for that. But one, this has not been a discussion in the Marine Corps. This was delivered to the Marine Corps. And it's very, very senior people on active duty and retired were ignored. And I would tell you, that's not one or two people. That's dozens of people that have reached out to me and told me the same thing. So to your point that this wasn't rolled out very well, here's my further comment. It wasn't created very well. It wasn't broad-based created. So either if you're going to be Harry Potter, you better be fucking right, because if you're not, you're going to have to stand in public and get corrected. And I think that's where we are.
I don't disagree with that. You know, because I just a couple things. You know, I would suggest that whenever you are sure that you're going to fight a certain enemy in a certain place, well, you can be pretty sure you're going to fight somebody else somewhere else.
Right.
And so if the idea is to make everything, you know, focused on fighting China in the Asia Pacific, then I think that is not the right approach. You know, like you can easily contemplate fights in, you know, the Persian Gulf area against Russia and the Baltics. You could actually take on the Chinese in the Horn of Africa. You know, a few things happen and some time passes. But and I think that we have to be ready for all of that. But what I would suggest is that we have got, regardless of where you fight anybody, that the way the technology has changed, that they can find us, they can hit us at long range. You know, that recent the Iranian missile attack on the U.S. base in Iraq, or on the Saudi oil fields. You know, that ought to make some people pretty nervous. Right. But it shows what even a second tier opponent can do to us. So right. the point being, we have to come up with like the Zulus, figure out how to deal with that Maxim gun, right. And ideally get better Maxim guns of our own.
Right. And so
I would suggest worldwide we have got to that what we're trying to think about towards the Chinese in the South in the Pacific. I would suggest that we should be thinking about the same basic things everywhere. And not just one place. And I, you know, hopefully that's not the commandant's intention. And that's where, as I say, I don't think it's been explained or very well at all. And right. I imagine Capitol Hill will have something to say about it.
But well, I would imagine a new Secretary of Navy will want to say, hey, look, yeah. when a guy of substance like Jim Webb writes something like this, right,
I would like to him to have continued his piece. You know, as I say, as it is, it didn't impress me very much. But it's sort of like when I start complaining about everybody, which I'm prone to do. Now what? What are you going to do about it?
What's your solution? I got it.
But if the idea is, well, the Marine Corps has this wonderful tradition, which it does. That we're just going to do more of it, that I would suggest prepare to lose if that's the case. So I think that this, this is a sort of one of these epical transformation periods, I think, where weaponry changes, you know, say from horse cavalry to tanks or longbow to crossbow, whatever, take your pick. And we would have to get through this, but not sort of give up all of it, not...
Well, and here,
right,
and so here's – okay, so I think this – let me read you an email. Mac, all this discussion about evolution or transformation, when somebody invents – and I'll dumb this example down for you because I know you're not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. Do you know in the movie Pirates of the Caribbean? I do. I've watched, I think, all of them. Do you remember the Kraken? Oh, I do. Are you kidding me? It like swallows ships, that thing. It's like this ugly kind of cross between Godzilla and a octopus, except it's more violent. Do you remember the pulse that the Kraken sends out? I do. It's terrifying. Okay. He goes on. All right. Now that I've got your attention, imagine when somebody cuts loose some kind of atomic, thermoelectric, pulsing thing underwater and neutralizes everything that's sensing in the water for X number of kilometers. Imagine that. Imagine that it's hundreds, maybe thousands of miles. Imagine when you do that in the air and you fry systems and you have the ability to do that over and over and over. All this revolution goes out the window, and as you rightly say, you're now groping in the dark for targets. Grant just said a minute or two ago, hitting Al-Assad and another fixed site, the Saudi fields. That shit's easy. The problem is dynamic targeting, which you quite rightly point out becomes much more problematic. Somebody will invent this stuff. I promise you that. If it's electronic in nature, it can be treated, it can be defeated electronically in nature. I believe this is evolution, not revolution. I believe the little Harry Potter weirdos are going to create those things. I believe much of that stuff will be neutralized, and then what you're going to have to do is fight to identify targets and then maintain that identification as you try to take them out. Love your show. Really like Grant. Really like Grant, although I am surprised that he's a karaoke or however the fuck you say that specialist.
He's surprised too, but they, I am, but the, with this, this whole discussion or debate that, it does seem as though that we do, there's some new technology that comes and then we figure out a counter for it, some way to over, then back and forth, sort of like code breaking. And you recall, remember the Falklands War, when the Exocet missile made its first appearance.
Right.
And it was so astonishing that there was all this talk, well, Navy ships are obsolete. They'll never be able to leave their ports again. And, that obviously didn't happen. But somehow, they say these clever guys figure out a counter to it, and then someone else figures out a counter for that and back and forth. That's something that, I would like to see, some commentary in the, in all of this about, there's these existing capabilities of long range precision weapons and smart autonomous drones, drone swarms, etc. That true. But so how are we going to counter these? And also we'll, what will we have there? We'll even have our better versions of them.
Right.
Because it is the fellow says, the listener says, this seems like an evolutionary, almost back and forth, trying to outdo the other guy sort of thing, rather than a fixed in time sort of problem. And, right. And that is part of the equation. That's one of the reasons why I'm still thinking through all of this, and I haven't figured it out, other than to know I... people probably don't want to join the Marine Corps to be part of a rocket force with two MOSs, maybe logistics and O8s.
You need a third one, the security guy that provides security.
Yeah, but it's, so I wish they as I've said, I think the focus on taking on China, the group that can beat us. I think that is the right thing. Right. But at the same time, I wish this had been presented better, because they, just from the plain language, there's some issues that I think most people pick up on, or a lot of people will, that need to be addressed. So
here's another email. Mac, it's interesting the mention of the Shore Watchers. It would seem to me that the capability that you really need is the target acquisition piece. What I would envision is more significant than Marines shooting some form of rockets is the target acquisition apparatus that they would remotely install and be able to turn on, turn off, and then displace with, knowing that they're going to be shot. Those kind of radars that would go hundreds of miles, that could be replicated throughout the region, gives you a coverage and therefore digital mastery in terms of target acquisition and target engagement. If you cannot replicate that, I do believe, although I don't know this stuff for sure because I haven't found a whole lot of it being written about phase one, all the satellites go, phase two, all other form of digital collection goes, and drones are being shot out of the sky at the cyclic rate, the ones that hang up there for 24, 48 hours. So now what you're left with are manned systems and unmanned systems, both surface, subsurface, and in the air, collecting and emitting. If it emits, it will be destroyed or jammed. So I see this is the real fight, not so much shooting, which gets a lot of attention. Be curious to what your guest has to say. Grant?
Well, I think he's right. To me, this is...
Coast Watchers.
Yeah, the comments, I think, get across just how the technology has shifted, yeah. and also how you have to operate. And it's just compare it to, say, what the Coast Watchers were doing. It's so different that it one, I think, if used to our advantage, that, you know, the way you put yourself in China's position, trying to get through sort of a zone that's covered in this way, and you can't find the end, you can't find your enemy, you can't hit him, but he can see you and hit you. That it, you know, this is something that, you know, used to make use of it, and you put to, this is what you're trying to do, is to make the cost so high for the Chinese that they will not right. start anything. And one can always say, well, why would they start anything? It's economically disastrous for them. Well, you know, the Germans invading Russia with half of the German transport being horse-drawn wagons, that was pretty stupid, but they did it. You know, countries do these sorts of things. So they, you know, the technology that they, you know, you can think of how you can make life miserable for an opponent using it. And I've heard some, a few years ago, some very good sort of artillery guys explain how they would operate in Asia Pacific. And I was impressed. And that was with what they had at the time, that I think that you can present the Chinese with really just such a terrible choice that they won't make a move, but you have to get that in place.
Right.
So the technologies is amazing. I wouldn't be surprised if within 20 years we wouldn't even recognize the way wars are fought. To some extent, you know, of course, it's every time you say you won't recognize it, it, you know, sure looks pretty familiar at a certain level. So, but there will be some things that are considerably different, I should think.
One more email, and then I will let you go because I know it's late. Mac, I have a question. Much of what we talk about relative to fighting in a digital age is digital. What happens when the fiber optic cables get cut between China and the rest of the world? Grant?
Well, they'd never do that. They're not smart enough.
What about – no.
I couldn't resist that.
How about if – no. How about we do it?
Yeah, you know, that's one of these questions that nobody likes to think about. You know, it's like, what happens when the internet goes down? You know, with as I understand it, the undersea cables are as vulnerable as they can possibly be, and that the Russians have been caught nosing around them,
right.
And I would imagine the Chinese are just as capable of it.
And
we are too. But
right, we do it too.
You know, that is the question that I hope somebody's thinking about, and how do we operate? And then you also, it's worth looking at Chinese activities in space as well, and that's, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, that everything is digital and high tech, but what happens when that isn't working? And
right.
One would certainly imagine if we see it as their vulnerability, they've probably saw it as ours long before us.
What you're describing, though, if you say, okay, let's just say that we blow those cables, so now they have no more data collection. So now all their cyber shit, and ours as well, goes out the window. And so your ability to do what? Shit in space? We blow their satellites up and we regenerate ours on a regular basis, like shooting all kinds of shit, like a battery six. We now shoot a battery of satellites into orbit, and we can do that for, you know, every day for a month, you know, or however long this goes, to regenerate our ability to do target acquisition and communicate. And so is it the scenario that is ultimately will be closer to World War II than anything that people see as transformational? Because the fight electronically will be to black everybody out.
I would guess that just clever people being
clever
what they
people,
are, that
right.
somebody's going to come up with a workaround, you know, when things go down, that there's going to be something that that still works, you know, on its own. You know, somehow there's, you know, I'm convinced.
But you're gonna have to fight. You're gonna have to fight to emplace that. And you're gonna have to fight to sustain it, right?
Oh, I don't know. You know, but somehow, you know, like I think that maybe like a lot of Americans that we, you know, we're just so used to. You know, there's always some smart guy in a laboratory somewhere. We're figuring it out. That, you know, I would like to think that, you know, we're not just going to sort of be groping, you know, once the electronic warfare and cyber warfare hits, that we'll have some sort of a, I don't know, maybe the equivalent of like, you know, a home generator where you get out when the power goes down.
Right.
You know, somehow the equivalent of something like that. You know, I'd like to think so. And it's certainly something that if we don't have it, then I'll probably start learning Mandarin instead of Japanese. Speak to my new masters.
Here's one more personal question. Fascinating that Grant is good at karaoke. And how long did it take him to learn Chinese? I mean, I said Chinese because you were just talking about Mandarin, but Japanese. How long?
Oh, boy.
For you to get good at it.
Some people would say I never have.
Until they hear 30 years,
I can give speeches in it.
Whoa.
But I sound like a combination of, say, Mr. Belvedere and like a caveman. So I speak of a pretty formal form of it. And then there'll be words that I should know that I don't know. Anyone who is conscientious, I think that within a couple of years, you can actually get pretty good at Japanese. Or you can master the 10 excuses that explain why you haven't gotten better. And I've figured it easier to master the 10 excuses. But one of the problems is that when you learn with the government, that they don't emphasize, they don't teach you to write, and they don't emphasize reading. So what you do is what you find is a lot of government types is they can sort of speak it, but it's a very narrow range because it's all learned orally. So it'd be like speaking English if you're illiterate, or say from West Virginia. You know, I couldn't resist that. But the you know, if you're illiterate, you can speak perfectly good English, but your vocabulary is limited and the usages. And that's what I think many Americans, particularly government types who learn that, where the reading and writing is not emphasized, that they have a narrow range that puts them at a huge disadvantage. But work at it a couple years, you'd be surprised. But if you really emphasize the learning to read it and the characters and is key, you just learn much faster and better that way. And it seems hard, but it's not actually. The way I look at it is, you know how a child has like 1,000 baseball cards, and he can look at any one of them and he instantly knows who it is. That it's, you can get the same way with the characters. So it's not all that hard to learn actually. Either really work at it for a couple of years or master the 10 excuses. Which that was my approach.
Somebody sent me this. Max, saw this from Wikipedia relative to where Jim Webb was born and raised. He was born in St. Joseph, Missouri, to James Henry Webb Sr. and his wife, Vera Lorraine Webb. Second of four children, grew up in a military family. Father served in the United States Air Force. As a matter of course, lived in Missouri, Illinois, Texas, Alabama, Nebraska, California, and Virginia, as well as England. His father flew B-17s and B-29s during World War II, flew C-47s in the Berlin airlift. His father and mother are both buried in Arlington National Cemetery. So there you have it.
Okay, but he did write a book, I remember, this was 30 years ago, about, because he's a Scotch-Irish ancestry, I think.
Yeah, born fighting.
Yeah, something like that. It's, but yeah, I obviously didn't find his piece as compelling as some might, but in terms of my regard for him, it's considerable. And as I said, 20 years ago, and we were trying to get some help with getting some attention paid to Asia Pacific. He was writing really well on it. And as I said, I think he uses the English language beautifully.
Yeah, no.
And if you go back to the stuff he's written years ago, it's always very good. And he's somebody you have to listen to.
Right.
You know, this one, this particular article, it didn't.
And what you're looking for from the article is the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say. Okay, now I know what you won't do. Tell me what you will do. Got it. Okay, I got that. Here's to me the significance of the article. It is the first person of significant stature to articulate what the vast majority of Marines, senior Marines, on active duty and retired, have articulated to me. He's the first person publicly to do that. And that's what I think the significance of the article is. So anyway, and so to me, there should be a healthy discussion about it. And I don't think that occurred prior to the Commandant's planning guidance being published. That is what I gleaned from my conversation. So we'll see if that happens now. But what's next in terms of writing, Grant? What are we going to see next?
Actually, on this topic, I think I've got a couple things to write. Is sort of about the shift that the Commandant's proposing, and there's a couple things that I've got in mind, and it's I'm still sort of thinking it through.
The significance of the Coast Watcher.
Oh, I like the Coast Watchers. But not just the Coast Watchers, but I'm trying to introduce what the Marines are proposing, and also at some point I'm going to have to write what I think of it, and I think I've probably get a sense of a little bit of it from what I've been talking about, but I still go back to those Zulus and the Maxim gun. We got to figure some of these things out.
Right.
To my way of thinking, right. You know, or where you find yourself with, outmatched. You know, that long lance torpedo the Japanese employed in Iron Bottom, what became Iron Bottom Sound. You know, just for what the first couple of years of the war put us at a huge disadvantage, and we really got to stay on top of the enemy's technology, and that's where and present him with what he would least like to face, not fight it the way we would like to fight it, always have. So.
I do believe, though, that per earlier in this discussion, the secret to it is the Pacific Defense Initiative, and that starts economically and diplomatically. And since we don't have a whole lot moving in that direction, to me, the rest of this is all. I don't know how to say it. It's all kind of nice to commiserate about, but you're not going to take your 30 ships if China dominates the region diplomatically and economically and sneak them in. That ain't happening.
That's right. If the China plays it right, they presented us with a problem where we can't move.
Right.
And that is the political warfare, which there's an economic component. And then the military one as well, but that's just one piece of it. As I say, if they get that, they think they're in phase one. They think the war's already started. But, we look at it, the shooting hasn't begun, so we think it's peacetime. But if they get it right, you can find yourself in a position where you can't move. They've got sort of military coverage, but also nobody in the region wants to let you in. And they're economically dependent or voluntarily or involuntarily on China, we're just sort of people tell us, well, thanks, it's been great, but please don't bother us. So we could easily find ourselves, in the equivalent of a full Nelson. You just can't move, even if you're kind of powerful. But that's what you've described is if we don't get the whole thing right, that it's going to be just militarily, you just made it a whole lot harder,
right.
If it's even possible to win. And that's the, I'm not quite sure who I would bet on in that case.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is when you look at the top 100 nations or so, and you look at their gross domestic product, and what you see with the free nations of the world are the United States comes in at like $21 trillion, something like that. The European Union, $18 trillion. Japan, $5 trillion. Germany, $4 trillion. India, $3 trillion. United Kingdom, $3 trillion. France, $3 trillion. Italy, $2 trillion. So if you begin to add up the free nations, you know, China's got a big economy, but it doesn't come close, right, to the power that the free nations of the world have. And that's why, to me, you know, to stand in concert and to open doors for the region and say, we want you to, you know, we'd like for you to embrace freedom and rules-based order so we can continue this economic growth, and we're here to help you. But, again, without leadership in the region, it's frustrating. It's frustrating. So I just pulled up the page on GDP and started looking at those numbers. You know, China's got a big economy, but guess what? It's a pimple on the free world's ass in terms of what everybody else has to offer. So
that's right. You know, people don't seem to remember that. You know, we did pretty well before 1989 when, you know, we sort of tried to bribe China into becoming civilized. You know, life was pretty good. People don't seem to remember that the American Republic and the democracies of the world, you know, got along pretty well. Life was pretty good without China, and it could be perfect. We could do very well without them again. It's a very small, it's a narrow group of Wall Street and America's pedigreed business class and part of the academia, which tries to claim that that without China, we'll live in some sort of howling wasteland, like Sherman went through Georgia. It's just not true. And, you know, we've somehow got to get us, you know, get off of this, you know, this mistaken notion that China is the key to our prosperity and any sort of decent life. It never has been, and it never doesn't have to be. So we'll see if we wake up. But you're right. Just do the math and look at China's GDP. It's like on a par with Paraguay or something like that. It's not very much. And if you go to China and get out of the shiny parts of Shanghai and the bigger cities, and this is like fourth world poverty. So one shouldn't, you know, there's more to China than, let's say, the handsome view of Shanghai. So it's you know, I hope we wake up. You know, we've talked about it before. It's going to take a 2x4 upside the head to wake up Wall Street. People on the Chinese payroll, but maybe that's what they'll get.
All right, sir. First of all, thank you very much for joining us this morning, and safe travels, and behave yourself, and good luck the next time you sing.
Well, thank you. I tell you, it is just amazing how well I sing. So you can catch it. I think I'm going to get cutting a DVD, a CD. Is that what they call it?
Podcast.
I'll do my best.
We'd like you to do a TikTok for us or something.
On Zoom.
Exactly. You can get something else up on YouTube, and we can start liking it, and maybe it'll go viral.
I doubt it.
Grant Newsham sings David Lee Roth.
Yeah, and Tom Jones. Okay, well, I always appreciate the chance to weigh in.
All right, thanks, Grant.
Righto.
There you have it, Grant Newsham, here on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. All right, that'll do it. No, you know, again, I always enjoy my conversation with Grant. I always learn something. Relative to, and he's right, Webb does not address what should the Marine Corps be. But let me tell you something that I find disturbing about all of this. When you don't see names like Gray, Mattis, Zinni, Van Riper, and a host of other, you know, generals that are known to be great thinkers. Webb, you know, as former Secretary of the Navy, and Senator. When you don't see names like that associated with a plan, there's a problem with it. Right? There's a problem with it. So, in my opinion, you know, the new SecNav is going to have an opportunity, in my opinion, to ask the Marine Corps, what are you doing? And why do we have guys like Jim Webb, right, arguing against the Commandant's planning guide? Why do we have that? What is going on here? And to me, that's a discussion that needs to be had. So, anyway, we'll probably talk about this again tomorrow. Will Costantini is going to join us. We're going to talk to him about the Secretary of the Navy designate, Admiral Brathwaite, testified last Thursday, I think. And so you're going to hear a little bit of the testimony tomorrow, and Will's going to come on. And we're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about force design. So, yeah, Will, smart guy. And, you know, he worked in what's known as the E-ring, which is the executive ring of the Pentagon. So he's no stranger to these discussions and how they go. So we'll talk about it some more tomorrow. So anyway, and let me just tell you, to me, what has to happen is, and again, my sense is that it hasn't. And that's the problem, is that the forum wasn't created and the buy-in wasn't received relative to a discourse with people that have gone down the road of force design, of other revolutions before, and how do they do it, and what do they do, and what is best for the Marine Corps. That discussion doesn't seem to be had. Now, maybe it was done in small group with people loyal to the Commandant, but I can tell you this, again, from talking to dozens of people, they don't feel like anybody's listened to them, and that is both retired and active duty. So I will leave it at that. So, on a Monday, if you're just tuning in hour one, you'll hear my thoughts on Mother's Day and my fascination for lawn sprinklers. And then we'll also talk about former Secretary Webb's and Senator Webb's op-ed piece. You can find the link to that in the hour one post. And you'll a little audio. And watching the news, I don't know how you escape the thought when you see the names with knowledge of what happened to Mike Flynn. I don't know how you escape the term conspiracy. It's stunning. And we'll talk about that. So you hear some audio from Maria Bartiromo's show that happened on Sunday. So have a great day. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. On a Monday, All Marine Radio, over and out.